that enables you to take a piece of this PDF and a piece of this PDF and put them together, huh? You got to pay $400 to do that, as far as I know. Huh? More or less. More or less. Like maybe you remember it better than I do. Yeah. It's on the board outside. Yeah. Okay. Thank you so thank you so much for staying. My goodness. You know, I like to be the last speaker on a Friday afternoon for many reasons. One is you learn who your real friends are. Also, I'm a slow talker, and please drift out whenever you have someplace else you need to be, and please interrupt me at any time. As I say, we're going to use bits and pieces from four other talks here, depending on whether it's a computer science, computing theory talk, or a game theory talk, or a discrete geometry talk. You know, we use this and that pieces. So the stuff here is with many other people, and you can email me if you want copies of the slides or anything else. Now, I like to start most of my talks with what an EP theorem is. An EP theorem captures formally, though it's expressed informally here, it captures mathematically what intuitively mathematicians regard as a beautiful structural theorem. Much of the slides I'm going to be using today we used at a week at the Institut Henri Poincaré in Paris last spring, a week called Pretty Structures. And, well, a pretty structure is the one that gives you an EP theorem, huh? For each possible instance of whatever exists, it's just an existence theorem, where for each possible instance of whatever exists, it's algorithmically easy to recognize any instance is algorithmically easy to recognize relative to the size of the input. So, for example, here's a... what exists is the output. Here, let's look at... Huh? The output of the theorem. What exists? What the theorem says exists? The theorem says, for any blah, blah, for any A, there exists B. Okay. For any A, there exists B. So this means that there's presumably some way, if you have an A, to get a B. And that B, then, is the output. And this existence theorem is an existentially polytime theorem if, relative to the number of bits in expressing the input A, whatever instance of B, any instance B of the output that you're handed, there's an easy algorithm for recognizing that it really is an instance of B. And this easiness is relative, you know, the number of bits is relative to the number of bits and the size of the input, you see? So let's look at an example you all know. For any set of boy nodes and set of girl nodes, an edge between a boy and a girl if she loves him, okay? So the theorem says, either there exists a way for all the boys to marry girls who love them. All right, so if an instance of if there exists a marriage or a matching of all the boys to girls that love them, well, whatever that is, whatever matching between boys and girls that is, it's easy to recognize that indeed that is a matching between the boys and girls, where a boy and girl are matched if they love each other. That's easy to recognize relative to the size of the input. That is the bipartite graph that tells you which girls love which boys, you see. Or there exists a way for all the boys, or there exists some subset of boys who aren't loved by enough girls. All right, there might be any instance of that, but, you know, one instance is, you know, this particular set of boys, you can count them. You can count the number of girls that love one or more of that set of boys. This is saying it's smaller, huh? You can easily recognize that. Easily relative to the size of the bipartite graph input, you see. So, this is an EP theorem. It says that something exists, and you take any instance of what it exists, it's easy to recognize relative to the size of the input, the structure. Got it? I don't understand you. The theorem is saying something exists. It might be a marriage of boys to girls, boys to girls who love them. It might be a subset of boys who aren't sufficiently loved. But that doesn't have to be an EP theorem. All the instances of what might exist don't have to have the same structure. In fact, you know, you might have, for a given input A, either B exists, or C exists, or D exists. That's an EP theorem, too, and you can take all of them, as many of these, disjunction of as many of these things that, no, actually, conjunction as you want. You see? Let's look at another example. Mosky's beautiful lecture yesterday, and why I'm so excited to figure out how, given a polygon in the plane, there exists a square whose four points lie on that polygon. Now, he presented it using simple closed continuous curves, huh? There exists a square with all four points on that closed curve. Now, I want to see this theory for a polygon, and then we can approximate the curves by finer polygons, but basically, the reason I want to study it this way is a very, very important technical reason, namely, the theorem. For any polygon in the plane, there exists a square whose four points lie on that polygon is an EP theorem. That is, you think about, you know, how much space, how many bits does it take to input the polygon, huh? And relative to that, if you're handed a square with its four points on that polygon, how much work is it to see that, in fact, it is what the theorem says exists? That is, it is really a square with its four points on the polygon. It's easy. It's an obvious algorithm. You know, if you're given the polygon and you're given such a square, it's easy. It's a polytime algorithm for recognizing that that is a square whose four points are on that polygon, right? And so, in general, and that's, you know, intuitively, that's why we regard that as a beautiful theorem, as a structurally beautiful theorem. But anyway, so EP theorems, in fact, are everywhere. You've got to massage what you know a little bit to put them in that form. And often they're given with non-algorithmic proofs, like Maschke's talk yesterday, you know? Or like, it's amusing to me that the crazy proofs that traditional mathematicians give of this theorem that would make you think, well, there couldn't, like, there's a famous paper by Halmos and Vaughan, a proof of this theorem. That's where I first learned it. Boy, you look and you, the way they state it, they say the boys can marry all the girls if and only if for every subset of boys, dot, dot, dot. If for every subset of boys, they're loved by enough girls, then there exists a way for all the boys to marry. Well, looking at this theorem, what, I'm going to look in order to find out if those boys can marry? I'm going to look at every subset of boys to see if enough girls love them? You know, that's a lot of subsets of boys, huh? So that's a stupid way to express the theorem. And secondly, you look at the proof. The proof not only is not a good algorithm, but it makes you think, well, surely an algorithm for this does not exist. A practical algorithm for this does not exist. Now, traditional mathematics is just totally rife with this kind of stuff, you know, the tricks that mathematicians use, you know, by contradiction, by induction, by blah, blah, to avoid for proving an EP theorem by giving you an algorithm for finding what that theorem says exists. Now, you know, if you're, presumably you're interested in the existence theorem, you're interested in a theorem that says this always exists, you'd think you'd be interested in a way of finding an instance of what exists. But traditionally mathematicians don't care. They just want their shortest proof that it exists. Well, in fact, the most beautiful and practical proof of this theorem is a very simple algorithm that, given the bipartite graph of the boys and girls, it finds for you either one way for all the boys to marry girls they love, or one subset of boys that aren't loved by enough girls. You know, one instance of what exists. That proves the theorem, but not, you know, by an algorithm, it gives you an instance of what the theorem says is there. So that's what I'd like to do with this, given a polygon, there always exists a square whose points are on the polygon. I'd like to prove that hands me one. And I'd like to know how efficient can I make it relative to the size of the input. So that's that kind of solidifying what traditionally mathematicians intuitively love is my motivation for as much as possible what I do. In fact, thinking of this 50 years ago is what decided me after I dropped out of university, decided me to do some mathematics after all, is getting this idea and feeling an urge to pursue it. All right, so we've looked at enough at those slides. Now, there are three kinds of game theory. There's the combinatorial parlor games, like Conway and Guy, written a massive two volumes, you know, games like chess and checkers and tic-tac-toe, and then competitive economic games and there are cooperative economic games. Three different types, qualitatively different types of theory. We're going to look now at an instance of each. And then after that, we're going to look at a discrete geometric way, since that's the subject of this week, we're going to look at a discrete geometric way to tackle these some of these game problems. Here's an easy parlor game. Now, if you figure out for homework, I'm not going to tell you how to solve it, but it's easy. It's one of those aha things, you know. If you see it, and if you see it, then you'll be able to get other people to pay for the drinks at the, you know, bar. You take a planar mat, for example, a general subset of the squares of a graph paper, huh? Just by, you know, a polygon, which is the boundary of the subset of squares, arbitrary. You let your opponent let one person chooses the subset of squares, and let him choose the subset of squares, and then you choose the first square. Anyway, after the first square is chosen, then you take turns choosing squares or regions. It doesn't have to be square. Any planar map, you can play this game on any planar map. Take turns walk across an edge from the last reached region, square, into an unreached region. And the player loses when he can't do that. Player loses when the board gets so congested that he cannot walk from the last reached square to a new one. I had that problem getting here today. I went home in Waterloo last night to get new teeth. See, I didn't want to. I wanted to have new teeth when I lectured to you today. And then coming back today, I drove about 20 miles an hour and I daydreamed and I turned off the wrong exit and it took forever to get here because of this problem here. Everything was so congested. Well, now, figure out a strategy for playing this game. I'll give you an even bigger hint. Not only does it use some well-known graph theory or something, it uses the marriage theorem. Or if you like, it uses the Kernig-Hall version of the marriage theorem. That says that, that's another EP theorem, where it says that given a bipartite graph and given a matching is a set of edges with no two hitting the same node, right? Given a bipartite graph and given a matching, either there exists a larger matching, easy to recognize if that's what's handed to you, or there exists a subset of nodes that hit all the edges, and that's the same size as the matching you've got. The normal way to say that theorem is that the maximum number of edges in a matching is equal to the minimum number of nodes that hit all the edges. But the interest of that theorem isn't that two maximization theorems happen to be the same. The interest of that theorem is that it gives you an easy way. It gives you a theorem that something always exists, and in whatever instance of it comes up, it's easy to recognize. Given a bipartite graph and given a matching in it, that's the input A, right? Either there exists a larger matching or there exists a covering by nodes that's the same size as that matching, which that'll prove it's the largest one. Obviously not both, but the interesting part is that one or the other always exists. That's certainly an EP theorem. That's another form. I mean, that follows easily from the marriage theorem as we saw it in the last slide. Anyway, that's what's used in solving this game. Solving means figuring out who's going to win, and an easy winning strategy for whoever can theoretically win. Theoretically has the capability of winning whatever the other guy does. This bipartite matching gives you the machinery for doing a strategy that always wins. Now, actually, that's a case that the squares on the graph paper. If it's an arbitrary map, then you need matching in a graph that's not bipartite, and the EP theorem for that is more complicated. But there is one. We're going to be studying in a couple of minutes. We're going to be studying matchings in graphs where edges have three nodes, you know, or four nodes, or however many nodes. Such theorems don't exist, but something closely related, EP theorems closely related, do. But before we get to that, let's look at, now, as far as competitive games, I guess the most famous theorem, the most famous theory in that subject is the Nash equilibrium theorem for bimatrix games. So let me say what that is. This is a two-player game. I can't see up there what the letters we use are. All right, there's a matrix R. There's a matrix R, and there's a matrix S, I guess. Is that what it says?
Yeah.
All right. Now, the matrix R, the columns, these columns are the possible strategy for player A. And the rows are the possible strategies for the player B. Or, I guess I should just use player R and player S. Down here, the rows are the possible strategies for player A, the first player, and the columns are the possible strategies for the second player. So there's a bijection between the columns here and the rows here. Bijection between the columns here and the rows here. Now, so the player A picks one of his columns, player B picks one of his rows. Whatever is there, that's the payoff to player A. Whatever's here, that's the payoff to player B. Okay? So that's a two-person game. You probably learn when you're studying linear programming, you probably learn zero-one sum, and at least you hear about it in popular TV shows, zero-one sum games, huh? What the one player wins, the other player loses, huh? That's where these two matrix, one is the negative transpose of the other. If one is the negative transpose of the other, then it's the game that von Neumann invented, and it's solved by easily as an application of linear programming. But here, it's not a zero-one sum game. You can have any numbers here, any numbers here, and this tells you what the first player will win. This tells you what the second player can win. Now, A mixed strategy is where player one, a mixed strategy for player one, is a probability distribution of playing these columns, you know? You play this one-third of the time, play this one one-third of the time, play this one one-sixth of the time, this one one-sixth of the time, huh? Yeah, that's the one, right? Probability distribution on the what you play, we'll call it, what do we call it? I should read my slide. Let's read this and see what it says. All right, so here's the vector, the probability distribution for the player A, huh? That x, its components add up to 1, and it's non-negative. This is a probability distribution for what player B does. This, then, this product is the expected payoff to the first player. Similarly, using the probability distributions this way, this is the payoff to the second player. Huh? Now, in general, there do not exist a pure strategy, one player, a single pure strategy for the one player and a pure single strategy for the other player that has the property that once these are chosen, neither player can do better to destabilize it. Huh? But the reason Nash got a Nobel Prize and had a movie made about him called A Beautiful Mind is that he discovered that every game has a mixed strategy equilibrium. Huh? That is, there exists a probability distribution X and probability distribution Y for the second player, so that, you know, all right, if we fix Y, then trying to maximize this over probability distribution, that's a linear programming, right? It'll be maximum. For a fixed Y, finding an X that maximizes this, where this is fixed, subject to the X being a probability distribution, that's a linear program. And stable means that this X is maximum for that linear program. And similarly, this is stable because with the X fixed, all right, B times X then is fixed. This is a linear program, huh? Maximizing that is maximum. Nash says such an equilibrium always exists, and we're going to prove it by an algorithm that finds it. I'm going to teach you the Lemke-Hausen algorithm that finds such an equilibrium, and it's going to be beautiful discrete geometry to do it. That'll be the main focus of the talk, is learning that algorithm, and it's something that, you know, you should be teaching to your undergraduates, exactly what I'm trying to teach you today. Now, let me see. All right. So we finished with that one. We'll get back to that in a moment, how to solve that game by discrete geometry. But let's look at the most famous instance of cooperative game theory. That also is some beautiful discrete geometry. Now, I don't know why Scarf didn't say it this way. He said it in a not nearly as nice way. This way of talking about it is due to Aharoni and Fleiner. Beautiful paper, 2001, Journal of Combinatorial Theory. They expressed it in terms of assigning weights to the edges of a hypergraph. I'm going to call the edges of that hypergraph, I'm going to call them coalitions. in order to teach you Scarf's motivation, Scarf's economic motivation for this. So we're given a list of subsets of n persons. Instead of calling those subsets the edges of the hypergraph, we're going to call them coalitions. So different coalitions, we can have multiple edges, that is, the different coalitions can be the same subset of people. For each person, we have a total, that is a linear, preference ordering of the coalitions that he's a member of. For each person, just we have his ordering of how much, you know, his first choice is labeled 1, his second choice of coalition is labeled 2, his third choice 3, and so on. You know, just like say these players are students and they're trying to decide what university to go to. They apply to all these universities. Now they know each university then is a coalition, right? And the student has in his mind, he has a preference ordering of these universities. Okay, so that's the idea. Now, a stable allocation is going to be an assignment of students to universities that is an assignment of let's get away from the university thing. I just made that up a second ago. Let's get back to what's written. Forget the university parable here. Each person, a stable allocation, a subset of mutually disjoint coalitions. Think of the coalitions maybe as companies, you know, and each person, he's going to work for one of these companies, and he has a preference order for the companies he might work for. And each coalition is a company with that particular mix of people working for it. So a subset of disjoint coalitions such that for every coalition not in that allocation, for every coalition not in that allocation, there's some person in that coalition who prefers the coalition that's chosen rather than that one. So that makes that allocation of coalition stable, huh? Meaning, you know, there's no player, no participant is going to want to hop over to a different coalition. Okay, now, actually, you may have heard of the stable marriage problem. That's a special case. Stable marriage problem is a special case where you've got a bipartite graph, and the boys and the girls, they're married now, you know, a matching between boys and girls, right? But each boy has a preference ordering on the edges that he's contained in. A preference ordering on the coalitions. The coalitions are the edges. The coalitions are the edges. Each boy has a preference ordering on those edges. Each girl has a preference ordering on the edges that hit her. Now, a matching between the boys and girls is stable if for every edge of the bipartite graph, you know, that is every possible marriage, one of the two parties, the boy or the girl, in fact loves who she's married to better than the person in this possible new marriage. repeat. A matching is stable if for every edge of the graph, one of the two end nodes prefers the chosen matching edge that it's in over this one. See, that's just a special case. It's just a special case of the coalition thing we've gone through again, but we restricted it to the edges, coalitions to being the edges of the bipartite graph. Now, in that case, the stable marriage theorem says that, indeed, a stable marriage always exists. Well, what about a stable allocation where, you know, we're talking about forming companies, you know, the coalitions are possible formations of companies. No, it does not always exist. In fact, it doesn't, the stable roommates problem, you know, in other words, where the graph is not bipartite. A stable matching does not, in general, exist. However, whatever the hypergraph, whatever the cooperative game, there always exists a fractional stable allocation of coalitions. A fractional allocations of coalition which is stable. Now, what do you think that means? The obvious thing. Well, this fractional allocation of coalitions means. It means we assign numbers. We assign numbers to the coalitions so that for each node, each person, the sum of the coalitions containing that node, containing that person, is at most one. This is simply saying, all right, you can work at three different jobs if you want to, but your total amount of time you've got to work at jobs is one, huh? And your total times at jobs can't be more than one. Actually, the one's not necessarily. We could have B. You know, this person, the maximum, the amount of time he has to work is B. The sum of the numbers on the coalitions containing that guy is at most B. Just for mathematical simplicity, we take the B's to be one. So that's a fractional. And of course, these are non-negative numbers. That's a fractional allocation. Now, what makes it stable? For any coalition at all, there exists some person, some node of that coalition, such that the sum of the coalitions that he's already in positively and he prefers over this one is equal to one. So in other words, he can't do any more. He can't take on any more jobs without giving up some work in one of the jobs he's already taken on. And the jobs he's already taken on, he prefers to this job. So he's not going to go along with this arbitrary coalition. That's what makes this fractional matching in a hypergraph stable. Well, Scott's theorem, modernized by Alfieri and Pliner, says there always exists a fractional stable coalition. There always exists a stable solution to Scott's cooperative game. Okay, we're going to talk about how that's solved, too. In fact, that's amazing. The main one of our results is, I'll tell you in advance, what we're really going to study is how to solve the bimatrix competition game. Amazingly, it turns out that this, in fact, is an instance by a reinterpretation of coalitions and players and so on. We can model this game and find a stable coalition by solving a bimatrix game. Now that's utterly amazing to me that the two most popular theorems and theories in these two areas of game theory, they turn out that in fact they're mathematically the same. Vlad Gurevich and I discovered that, and it blows our minds. So the result is the scarf cooperative game is a special bimatrix game. All right, let's now get to some geometry, the geometric tools for solving this kind of thing. An Euler complex, OIC is simply a phonetic short for Euler complex. Get it? Euler OIC, OIC, okay. Euler complex. A d-dimensional Euler complex. It's the same thing as a hypergraph, if you like. Topologists like to use the word complex instead of hypergraph. Economists like to use the word coalitions instead of hypergraph. Different words for the same thing. We speak of complex because we're using topological ideas, and we call it an Euler complex because it generalizes a one-dimensional Euler complex, which means an Euler graph. An Euler graph, first a simple graph, is a one-dimensional OIC, right? A one-dimensional complex. And it's an Euler graph. Every node is in exactly an even number of edges. All right? That's an Euler graph. Euler invented that. Every graph theorist knows what an Euler graph is. It's that. A graph where every node is in an even number of edges. And so a two-dimensional OIC is a collection of triangles. And such that every wall, every two-dimensional facet, every facet is in an even number of the triangles. So I apologize for this lousy. Can you see my cursor? Oh yeah, so I can point here. Hey, I can look at this and point here, and I don't even have to look up there. Hey, that's good. Okay, so this is terrible notation here. That's just a myth. What we mean, that's a one-dimensional OIC. An Euler graph is a one minus D doesn't mean minus D. It just means one-dimensional. Huh? One-dimensional OIC is a graph. So there you go. And an OIC is called a manifold OIC. A D plus 1 each of the sets of the complex have d plus 1 elements. It's called a d-dimensional complex. We call these the rooms, the highest dimensional cells of the complex. For convenience, we call the rooms. And now if you delete a node of a room, you have a wall of the room. Uh-huh. Now, you know, we could use other terminology, but the reason this terminology is not because the structure is new. Hell, it's used all the time by everybody. Why do some people call a graph a network and some people call a network a graph? Well, it sort of identifies which community you're in, you know, which what you're doing with the structure, right? So the same mathematical structures often have many names, and so we're giving this funny name to a hypergraph, first because that's the topological terminology used, and that's where we're coming from. All right, so a manifold oik is each wall is in exactly two rooms. It's not moving. I think it got tired of listening to me and went home. Ah, there we go. All right, so here's a two-dimensional manifold oik. Forgive me for that minus D there. I don't know why that stupid thing is there. Triangulation of a surface is a two-manifold oik, huh? And the vertices of the oik are the triangulation, and the edges of the oik are the walls of the rooms, huh? And each wall is in exactly two rooms, this one and this one. Do you see my cursor? Do you see a cursor moving around there? Huh? Yeah? All right, so this wall is in two rooms, so that's a manifold, right? Now, the problem we're going to study is, and it's in the title at the top, you know. Partitioning, in the title of the talk, I think it says partitionings of the vertices of a polytope by its facets. All right. Here we're calling the facets the rooms, and we're calling the vertices, huh? Room just means a facet. And a wall means a wall of this room is, if you leave out that vertex there, then you get this wall. All right, so there's a partition that's a two-dimensional polytope surface there. And there's a partition of facets into partition of the vertices into a subset of the facets, right? So that's the main thing of the talk, and the reason it's the main thing is we're going to use this idea to solve the bimetric scheme problem. That's just a review of the stuff we've said. For every oik, there's an even number of partitions of the vertices into rooms. So in particular, here's a graph theorem that, as far as I know, is not, I don't know if it's generally known in graph theory, but every Euler graph has an even number of perfect matchings. Might be zero, just a triangle is an Euler graph. It doesn't have any perfect matchings, right? But every Euler graph has an even number of perfect matchings. Every one-dimensional oik has an even number of room partitions. We call them matchings. Remember, we're going to call the matchings room partitions, partitions of the vertices using rooms. We're going to call it that because we don't want to get confused with matching theory and graph theory. That's really a different, quite different theory than this one. So we're using different words for the same thing, just to flag the fact that we're talking, making a different use of these objects. Every theorem, every oik, no matter what dimension, there's an even number of partitions of the vertices into rooms. And so if there's one room partition, then there is another room partition. You see two room partitions of our two-dimensional oik. Here's two room partitions of our one-dimensional oik. Let's look at the algorithm that proves this for this instant, the proof of this theorem. Of course, that's an EP theorem, right? Given an oik, and given a partition of the vertices into rooms, that's the input A, the output B, there always exists another partitioning of the vertices into rooms. Given any polytope, any partition of the vertices by facets, there exists another room partition of the vertices by facets. Relative to the size of expressing the polytope, or more generally, the manifold, triangulated manifold, relative to the amount of bits it takes to write down that input, it's easy to recognize that, write down the triangulation and write down a particular partition in the rooms. That's the input. It's easy to recognize, if you're handed another room partition, it's easy to recognize that it is another room partition. It's different from the one you have, and it is a room partition. So that's an EP theorem. So we would hope to prove that theorem by an algorithm that, given the one, finds the other. In fact, there's an even number of them because they fall into pairs. These room partitions fall into pairs. Every room partition has a brother room partition. For any polytope, any superficial polytope of any dimension, in fact, for any triangulated surface of any dimension. So, and here's the proof of it. Oh, here I've slipped in manifold slink. Now you can remember slink, planar slink. I taught you you figure out the strategy for the parlor game, then you can win drinks. Walk from one room to another. You walk from one room to another. Take turns walking from one room to another until it's not any longer possible to walk to a room that hasn't already been reached. Okay. You can play that there. You can play it on an oriented matrix. You can play it on anything. It's solved. It's well solved, but that's your homework. Okay, here's how to find another room partitioning. I'll just show you a picture of the algorithm, rather than trying to read it. You choose a special node. Here's our input. We've got a triangulation, and we've got a room partition. You choose some node, say W, to be special. It doesn't matter which one. Once you choose your node W, your arbitrary node W, then you have a pairing of room partitions. Once you've chosen W, then we're going to see how to get its brother room partition. So here goes. We remove the room containing W. That leaves this wall here, right? Can you see my cursor? Shout, yes, teacher. Okay, so there's the wall. So we're going to remove that room. So we got to put in that room, right? The unique other room using the same wall. Ah, but gee whiz, we bump into another person there. That's not a room partitioning. So what do? Well, of course we remove this room and put in this room, right? And then, but now we got to remove that one. So we got to put in this one. But now we got to. Now we got to remove this one, but that means we had to put in this one. But that bumps into that, so now we got to remove that one and put in that one. But that bumping in. So that's the algorithm. We keep doing that. There you go. There's our other room partition. There's another partition in the vertices into facets. So that's the algorithm. Pretty nice algorithm, huh? Well, besides discovering the algorithm and the theorem, our main work is to prove that that's a bad algorithm. You'd think, I mean, that's right, pretty, right? You just, you know, in, out, in and out, and we can easily prove, we haven't run out of time, which I guess we will. I can easily prove to you that algorithm terminates with a new room partition. But what's a little trickier is, and surprising, is that algorithm in general grows, the number of pivots grows exponentially with the size of the given triangulation. So what we do, what I'll show to you, if you don't walk out on me, what I'll show to you is a sequence of triangulations, starting with this one, that where I the number of rooms goes up linearly, but as the number of rooms goes up linearly, the number of pivots in this algorithm doubles, so it's exponential. Huh? So that was a surprising discovery. Now really surprising to me is we do not know a polynomial time algorithm. We do not know a good algorithm for finding a second room partitioning. Given the triangulation, given one room partition, we know there exists another room partition, but we do not know an efficient algorithm for finding one, and that's an open problem. Any discussion? You're gonna walk out on me in 5 minutes, huh? Can't hear you. Oh, no, the same works, good, thanks for asking. The same works for any oik, where every wall, remember, oik is where every wall is in an even number of rooms. The essentially the same algorithm for, in other words, works for a second, finding a second perfect matching in an Euler graph, and we will look at it. However, well, for a manifold oik, once you've chosen that special node W, the algorithm is uniquely determined. Huh? It's not uniquely determined for a non-manifold oik, huh? But we can make it uniquely determined by, for each wall, all right, so, and we make good use of this. We would get to this if you hang around. For each wall, we pair up the rooms that it's contained in. Each wall is in an even number of rooms. All right, you say, okay, well, this wall goes with this room goes with this room. This room goes with this room. This goes with this room. So now, effectively, I mean, geometrically, topologically, you imagine we're splitting that wall out apart. Nothing's saying that this manifold has to be a real, you know, pseudo-manifold is fine, huh? Pseudo-manifold is fine. We don't need it to be topologically Euclidean at the vertices, right? We split apart like that, and now we have effectively a pseudo-manifold, and we apply the algorithm that we just learned. So that's the way it works. And actually, I have later, it's important here, that we have, we look at an instance of this. But first, I should say, what does this have to do with games? Well, now, did you ever know the good way to represent a polytope? Well, for you got a given set of vertices, you know the right way to represent a polytope? B is non-negative. X is required to be non-negative. A simplex tableau, just like in the simplex method. Now we're leaving out the row for an objective function. We don't have an objective function here. But otherwise, this is a tableau for a simplex method. Now, the columns are the vertices, the points. What are the facets of this simplicial polytope? Oh, and we're assuming non-degeneracy. That is, no matter how you pivot, these right-hand sides stay different from zero. That's non-degeneracy. We also assume we're bounded. Remember, once we, for a given tableau, all right, we set the x's multiplying these columns equal to zero, then the x's multiplying these columns are equal to whatever's on the right-hand side, right? So we want the right-hand side to stay non-negative because we want the x's to stay non-negative. It's a simplex method. All right, now, what are the vertices of our simplicial polytope, the columns? What are the facets of the simplicial polytope? In other words, the rooms. We're calling them facets, rooms. What are the rooms? What are the rooms? Raise your hand if you know what the rooms are. If these columns are the points, then what subsets of columns are facets? Raise your hand if you know. Okay, I'll tell you. They are the complements of feasible bases. Feasible basis means we can pick any position here, and we can pivot by subtracting multiples of this from all the others to get a 1 here and zeros here, and then we get garbage here, right? That's what's called pivoting. Now, we can only pivot. So we got to pivot so that the right-hand side stays negative. All right? When the right-hand side is negative, then that's called the feasible basis. This is called the basis. This is called the non-basis. The facets of the simplicial polytope are the points, the columns of the non-basis. Now, walking from room to room, as we did here, geometrically, walking from room to room is the ratio test for pivoting in the simplex method. Say we're in this room, and we want to walk to a new room. All right, well, no, oh, I'm sorry, not, that's all the room, that's all, we're in this room, and we want this column to leave the basis and some one of these columns to enter the basis. In other words, leave the non-basis. We want this column to leave the room, some one of these columns to enter the room. There's only one way to do it. It's called the ratio test of the simplex method. You divide this by the right-hand side. There's only one way to pivot so that that stays non-negative. In other words, there's only one way to walk from a room to an adjacent room. It's unique. So it's a manifoldoid, huh? Now a little more work will show you that in fact it's a polytope in the sense of a convex hull of a finite set of points in general position. But that's what we're doing there. Okay, so pivoting is the same thing as walking from room to room. So we know how to apply this algorithm to a general polytope. It looks like the chairman wants me to stop, so you're going to have to come back next year to hear the rest of this lecture. The next step is to, let's go through this. The next step is to describe special oiks like the Gale oiks that come from cyclic polytopes. And here's an example of that shows you how finding room partitionings solves the bimatrix game, tells you how to find a Nash equilibrium using room partitionings. That's what that stuff is about. I wasn't going to go through all the details of it. This is a Gale oik. This shows applying it to answer you, Mosky. Here we've got a one-dimensional oik that's not a manifold. We split it in this way to get the same thing, finding a matching in a one-oik, it's the same thing as finding a colorful, lots of combinatorial geometry like colorful syntax myth. All right, so colorful or rainbow matching. A colorful matching or rainbow matching, it's a matching such that every color is used once. Well, there's always another rainbow matching, and there's an algorithm that does it, and that shows how it's a a special case of the SCARF cooperative game, and blah, 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 blah. Thank you very much. And then there's another sequence of slides here that proves to you very beautifully that this algorithm, this pivot algorithm for solving a bimatrix game or finding another room partitioning, grows exponentially. Now, it took years for us to find a polynomial time algorithm for linear programming. We still do not know a polynomial time algorithm for solving a bimatrix game. This algorithm is beautiful. It works very nicely in practice, just like the simplex method does. But we prove that it is not polynomial. It grows exponentially with the number of rooms. Thank you.
Thank you. Before I thank the speaker again, I'd like to mention three things in behalf of all the participants. I think this is the last one. First is, we would like to thank Sarah Redbeck, and in a broader sense, other co-organizers for organizing this workshop. Secondly, I'd like to thank the Peace Institute for providing safe technical support for this workshop. And finally, I wish for the long-term participants. If there are other questions about the talk, probably there will be time for that. Otherwise, thank you for this talk. And
yeah, thank you. Oh, so there is time for somebody to ask me a question?
Yeah. No.
Oh, good. And part of the title says, and dominating sets and perfect graphs. Doesn't somebody want to ask me what the hell I'm talking about there, dominating sets and perfect graphs? If you've got a directed graph, a kernel is an independent set of nodes such that every node outside has an edge directed into that stable set, that independent set. Then that's called a kernel. Now, if a directed graph, first, every cycle has no directed cycle. Every directed graph has no cycle. If a directed graph has no cycle inside a click, and if the graph itself, the undirected graph, is perfect, then it has a kernel. That was a conjecture of Pierre Bayes and Duchesne 20 or 30 years ago, and my buddy Gurevich proved it, and other people have proved it. Well, that is the same thing, and you can do this for homework. That is the same thing as saying that if a SCARF cooperative game, remember the hypergraph of coalitions, the edges of the hypergraph are the coalitions, and remember we have a stable fractional coalition. When do you have a pure stable allocation of coalitions? When the line graph of that hypergraph is perfect. When the line graph, you check this for homework. It's easy to see. To say that an allocation, a pure state allocation, not a fractional allocation, a pure allocation is exactly the same thing as a kernel in the line graph. Thank you. Any other questions? Yes.
In like simpler cases where you're like the case where you have the graph and your room partitions are like these maskings or the cases of triangles, do you know in those cases if the algorithm is polynomial?
No. No, we prove it is not.
Okay.
With that algorithm that I taught you, we prove that it is not polynomial. We prove that we show you a construction, if you stay another 15 minutes, that will double the number of triangles in the triangulation. It'll increase by a constant amount. Each time we increase the number of triangles by a constant amount, we show the number of pivots doubles. And so that algorithm is not polytime, and we do not know a polytime algorithm for this room partitioning. We do not know a polytime algorithm for solving the bimatrix game problem finding a Nash equilibrium. We don't know if there is a polynomial time algorithm for that. It's kind of in the same state now that the linear programming was in about the time you were born. Huh? See what I mean? Thanks for asking. Any other discussion? All right. Well, thanks a lot for coming. And let's find a good algorithm, or at least find a beautiful algorithm like this. Let's find an algorithm for finding, given a polygon, finding a square with all its points on the polygon. Let's find an algorithm for doing that, and let's see if it's polynomial time. Let's see if it's a good algorithm.